all the other bodies move, because you said in the beginning all bodies in the universe are moving in such and such a direction. So you could only say everything in the universe is governed by God if you made an exception. But there are certain things that are not. You see? Then, according to logical analysis, you could have made a meaningful statement. But when you start making statements about everything, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't prove it, you can't disprove it. And so they say, although you think you have said something, you haven't really said anything at all. You made a statement that was actually as nonsensical as asking, why is a mouse when it spins? But this statement about God doing or ruling all things sounded meaningful because we're used to it, but is really pure nonsense. This has been so persuasive in the climate of academic philosophy today that idealism of all kinds is, as I said, extremely unfashionable. But there are considerations that might cause us to reflect on this more carefully. Because we can think of situations analogous to the idea that all things are ruled by God, or all things exist only in the mind. There are situations analogous to that in our everyday experience. Only we can be aware of these situations because we stand outside them. Now, first of all, consider a mirror. A mirror will reflect all kinds of shapes and colors. And when you look at the mirror itself will be the ground or the underlying element common to all those shapes and colors. And it is not meaningless to say that they are all reflections in a mirror, because the mirror has an edge, and you can see other things around the mirror which behave in a different way from the reflections. You can't put your hand out and pull the necktie of a reflection in the mirror. But you can reach your hand out and pull the necktie of somebody standing beside the mirror. You see? But nevertheless, within the context of the mirror, all the things that are there are reflected in it. And if the mirror weren't there, they wouldn't be there, those reflections. Now, supposing similarly, everything that exists has its being in a mirror called the mind. Only, there is no way of seeing the edge of this mirror. Is that meaningful? Is that possible? The positivist, the logical analyst will say no, because the statement makes no difference to anything. It makes no difference to anything in this thing you call the mind, that it's in the mind. It makes no difference to anything in the mirror, that it's in the mirror. For example, your face is not immediately changed by being reflected in a mirror. The mirror doesn't exercise influences, or so they say, upon the reflections, but it very well could. Let's consider what we were discussing last night. Lenses in cameras influence the kind of world they photograph. A convex lens will give you one thing, a concave lens will give you another thing. And one can think of all sorts of wonky lenses, prismatic lenses, bent lenses, squirrely lenses. Now you see, if the lenses of your eyes could be said to distort the physical world, you would take that distortion as normal, because there would be no way of setting up a standard and saying, by that standard my eyes are wrong, unless you simply took some other kind of a lens and said, this is right, and the eyes distorted. You would have always seen things that way. So, nevertheless, whether the eyes are distorted or not distorted is impossible to decide. So, according to this way of logic, that is a meaningless question. There is no way of deciding the answer, and it makes no difference whether it is or whether it isn't, or so they say. But I think that they have neglected certain kinds of difference that these things do make. First of all, there is a difference of feeling, and very often a difference in behavior, between a person who is aware of an underlying ground or continuum for every experience and every reality, and a person who is not aware of it. The person who's aware of it feels at home in his surroundings. The person who's not aware of it doesn't. The first belongs, and the second doesn't feel he belongs. He feels he's engaged in a contest. Furthermore, one of the difficult ideas to get across and express well in any language which wants to be, to assert a pluralistic universe in which there is no unifying ground, any language based on that assumption is going to have difficulty talking about relationships. Let's go back in the history of philosophy and look at former instances of this difficulty. The thing that really bogged Descartes down and that puzzled him, he never could answer, was the relationship of mind and matter, or spirit and matter. He had inherited from Platonism and from Christianity the theory of the two worlds, the natural and the supernatural, the material and the mental, the real and the ideal. And what never could be explained by the philosophies of the people who believe that way was how the one influenced the other. How does the spiritual world influence the material? As is well known, all ghosts, all good, well-behaved ghosts, walk straight through walls without budging a brick. Now, if my mind is my ghost within me, how on earth does it lift my arm when a ghost doesn't budge a brick when it walks through a wall? See, this is the real problem. It all sunk on this. They couldn't explain that. And you see, in just the same way as the Cartesian cannot explain the influence of mind on matter, so a person who works according to the theories of logical analysis can't really explain relationship between so-called things. If he's going to take a pluralistic theory of the universe, in which all of which there is no unifying continuum, but there are just these events, you see, there are these things we can talk about in a scientific descriptive manner. How are they related? They obviously are related. They obviously influence each other. But how? Put it in another way of historic philosophical problem. How does a cause influence an effect? Kind of amazing, you know, that they do. We say there are causes and effects. But how does a cause lead to an effect? Is it something like a row of dominoes that stand on their end, and you flip down the first one and they go clickety, 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 and all knock each other down? Or a row of billiard balls? That was the idea of Newtonian physics, of course. That the atoms were things like billiard balls, and they banged each other around. And so you got results. But this really won't do. For very many reasons. One is, of course, that things influence each other backwards. A future event can change a past event. A lot of people aren't aware of that, but it can. If I say, the bark of the dog and the bark of the tree, what happens to bark, the former event, is very seriously influenced by the later event, dog or tree. Although the word sounds the same and is spelled the same, it has a different meaning according to what happens later. So in the same way in music, what is happening at this moment may be changed altogether by something happening later. A note has one meaning in one context, another meaning in another context. So what is the cause-effect relationship between them when apparently the earlier event seems to be causally affected by the later event? You see how puzzling all that is. But it's very easily illustrated by certain phenomena of music. When a person is tone deaf, that is to say, he cannot hear melodies. He only hears noise, and he can't understand why other people find music attractive. What is his deficiency? Where is he blind? His blindness is that he cannot hear relationships, or rather, in musical language, he doesn't hear intervals. If you are musically sensitive, what you hear in a melody is not a string of notes. You hear the steps between them. You recognize the major scale of C as ascending. Why do we think of that as up? What does it mean that one sound is higher than another? That's nonsense to a person who's tone deaf. There are just different sounds. There are boomy sounds and squeaky sounds, but they don't rise. You see, he hears no motion in them. Because, you see, each note is static, and he doesn't hear the lead from one to the other, the step. Well, so a person who is a logical positivist is a tone-deaf philosopher. See? And you can't explain, there's nothing you can do to a tone-deaf person to explain how you hear music, just as there's absolutely no way of making a congenitally blind person understand color. Or we may find out one eventually, when we find out a lot more about our senses. But in the ordinary way, he just can't get it. And so in exactly that same way, there are people who cannot get certain things. We say of such people, you know all the words, but you don't know the music. And you may as not well not waste your energies trying to convince, but there are, alas, these poor, afflicted souls who just aren't functioning on a certain wave band. But now I don't want to say, you know, make a kind of a esoteric scene out of this. A lot of people are trained to pretend that they are not on that wave band. You may be perfectly capable of understanding the relationship between a cause and effect. You know what the relationship is? It's very simple. They're the same event, only divided into two parts. If you see a cat walk by a very narrow window, you see first the head and a little later the tail. If you speak in cumbersome philosophical language, you're going to start talking about the event head being the cause of the event tail. Well, it's all one cat. And that's it. So when you see causes and effects, what you're saying is this. Aha! I realize at last my perception is limited. And when I saw one thing that's invariably followed by something else, what I hadn't noticed is that they are continuous with each other. So that when one part of this pattern arises, I should expect the other part. They're one pattern. They're not cause and effect. They're not something that is an action and a response to that action, an action and a reaction. They're a single action. That's why they're related in this way. All right, so I've got these two discrete events, and I've called them cause and effect. But I find they are really one. Okay, in exactly the same way, I've got the two discrete events, you and I. We could equally well, couldn't we, say that there may be some sense in which they are one. Or the organism and the environment. It's becoming plainer and plainer that they are one. Now, what this goes back to, again, we are looking at philosophical history, is the Western debate between the two schools of thought called the nominalists and the realists. And the modern logical philosophers are nominalists. Now, their fight is as follows. The realists say, there are real, this is how they get the word realist. It's not what we call a realist today at all. It's quite different. The realist says there are, in reality, substances which could be called matter, or spirit, or humanity, just to take an example. Every individual human being is an instance of something called mankind, and mankind is a real entity. Would say, too, the United States of America is a real entity. And all these individual examples of it are, as it were, members of a body constituted by the real mankind, or the state, or the society, or the church, or the whatever. In contradistinction, the nominalist says, all your so-called real natures are abstractions. There is no such thing as mankind. There are simply these individual people. And calling them all men is a way of identifying them, but there is no such thing as mankind. In the same way, there is no such thing as the United States. There are all these people living here who imagine that they're the United States and call themselves that. But the United States as such has no physical existence, because when you say the policy of the United States towards Russia is thus and so, you don't mean the policy of the geographical territory. And nominalism, you see, is a very big thing for the followers of Korzybski and for all logical analysts and so on, because they take the point of view, the whole thing in Korzybski is that you mustn't just go around calling things dogs, but you must recognize there is Fido sub 1, Fido sub 2, and Fido sub 3. And so this helps you, as the song says, to see each doggy differently. So the idea in semantics is this tremendous precise accuracy.